So then what was next?
Then I graduated. I mean, I went to, I tried to get the University of Michigan, but I couldn't. So I stayed at home with my aunt in Lithuania. And my aunt was very good to me. And I majored, well, when I graduated as an undergraduate, I majored in history, journalism, and English. And after, in my senior year, I met this young lady I married to. She was a freshman. She came in, and I had known her stepmother because her stepmother had been in an economics class with me. I was trying to avoid a certain professor, and so I took her at night because she was in her class. And I used to ride home with her in the streetcar. I'd walk her home because I knew this. Shirley says, the only reason I dated her was because I only lived a block and a half from her house and she was a cheap date. But anyway.
Now, was this still on King? Or
on King. She lived on Alger.
Okay.
So, I knew when I graduated that I wasn't going to be a journalist. I was going to go take teaching because I needed a job. Mm-hmm. So I took elementary education. In 1950, I started teaching. In 1952. 3 months after I started teaching, in April, I got married. Hmm. And we have 4 children. Now, my interests, being a northerner, basically, I knew very little about what I call the black presence in the United States. And I knew about Booker T. Washington, but that wasn't something you taught in the history. It was taught in the history department at Wayne University. Mm-hmm. And so about when I was teaching, let's see, about 1962, I kept up with this. I read about the civil rights movement, the student sit-ins at the lunch counters, and Martin Luther King's bus boycott, and all that. And I didn't really know about. I mean, knew about it, but I could not articulate the concept of institutional racism. You know, it was there. It was there all my life, and it's still there. And, but anyway, my principal, Fred Harrington, I was teaching, first I taught from 1952 to 50, June 58, I taught at Breitmeyer Elementary School. 1958 until June of 1965, I taught at Barber Junior High School, which was another. I was lucky to be there at the right place at the right time because Barber was one of the great city schools and you had a number of resources, like I could take kids to concerts, I could take kids to dinner, I mean to plays and stuff like that. And we had a ball of kids in my homeroom and we went places and I would take them to Lansing and to go there to Slim Little Colleges like and stuff like that. So getting a bus was no problem in those days because of the money that the Ford Foundation pumped into the Green Cities program, which was an attempt to redress the middle class flight from the city of Detroit and they felt that remediation and some enrichment was the answer. Mm-hmm. The guy who was in charge of the program, Carl Marburger, went on to become assistant superintendent for special projects. Later he was, he and Drochler were vying for the superintendency. And Drochler, Wolf, and Marburger was mostly Wolf and Marburg, and Dracula wasn't even in the picture, I don't think. But somehow, Castle and Wordling were able to get Drive and Dracula got it. Marburg left and went to Washington to be head of Indian Affairs. Then he became superintendent for instruction for the state of New Jersey. Dracula was one of the king of the great superintendents, and Wolf followed him. And my career downtown started as an acting supervisor in a social, well, the summer of 65 was a great summer for me because I worked all summer at great, you know, in the Great Cities Project. Okay. And I was on the social studies department on that hit list. And I had heard about, I said to Lou Monticello, the late Louis Monticello, who was our boss, what is this JAA? He said a JAA is merely a person who works, who's a department head who works 12 months. And we said the magic word 12 months, you know, because every summer was famine almost, mm-hmm. you know. Until I got back and started working. But fortunately for me, my wife's aunt had a business, and she was very kind to us. And if I needed some money, all I'd do was write a check and put it in the till and they'd hold it for a couple of months if needed. Okay, you know. So those kinds of things helped me and helped us immeasurably. And I'm always being indebted to her aunt. Still alive, thank God. But anyway, then I was called downtown, which was a big deal in 1965 to be an acting social studies supervisor because there were only about two or three black people in that whole building.
Really?
It was in 1965 as administrators and very few secretaries. It's hard to conceive, but that's, And I worked down there for a year, for a semester. Then I went out, I applied for junior administrative assistant. Then I went down to Pershing because I had no high school experience. I was taught at Pershing for about 2 months and then about a month really. And Al Schiff, who was the second in command in personnel, called me and asked me if I could go like to be in his department. Mm-hmm. So it was a big deal. I said, yeah. And I came downtown. Immediately I was put in charge of the teacher aid program and hiring people for the federal program. And that was an experience. What's his name? Her name, goodness, a woman, a beautiful woman by the name of Elizabeth Schenker became my secretary. She was outstanding. And she helped me more than anybody, you know, because they gave me an office and we had to find every time for orientation. So I had to go right in. I made a lot of mistakes, but she helped me. And then in 1966, January, around February, then about 67, a year later, Stu Rankin wanted me to work with him at this Michigan, Ohio Regional Educational Laboratory, so I worked half-time for the board and half-time for him. In July of 67, I went with him full-time. This was another great experience for me. And Stu Rankin eventually became a very good friend of mine. And it opened my eyes to a lot of things. And I was away from the board. Morrell closed, lost its funding in 69. I got one of the last sabbaticals and worked in a doctorate up in Michigan. Took classes from Sidney Fine, etc. And then I came back to the board 1970, June. And then I was assistant director. I'd gone to assistant director and staff development. And then I worked there until one of the things that I did that I'm proudest of was that our boss, Cheryl Stewart, had a stroke, and then he fell on a knee and had to have it amputated. And after, with Helen Hart and I used to run the department, and when we went through this desegregation process, I helped to write the plan. I was in charge of writing the plan, and I also implemented it. She was in charge of the department. And I took some of the money, I was able to steal some money from that, so our kids could go to some place in the Ozarks to National Academic Game. You know, mm-hmm. They go there every year now, but you know, I was able to mm-hmm. get the first one going by using federal money. And and I stayed in staff development from 70 to 77. Then I was put in charge of social studies. And I was there from 77 to February 1st, 91.
February 1st? Oh. Oh, you worked through January. You worked an extra month.
Well, no, I got, I had to use up my vacation time.
Oh, okay.
That's how you do that.
Oh, okay. Let me go back, and I remember on the list of things you were interested in talking about, Paradise Valley was one of the things that
I remember Paradise Valley.
You were not living here, but you came
in. No, I used to come in, and when I was a teenager, I used to come down every summer.
Uh-huh, okay.
And I can remember Geraldine Wetzel taking me down to the YMCA to some kind of seminar. She was always very serious-minded.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember her mother, they were very, they were not, nobody could ever call them communists, but they were very liberal. Mm-hmm. They were liberal. And Mrs. Wetzel had grown up with Paul Robeson. She never lost faith in him, as some people did.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't know that.
And Jerry's mother. He's a good friend of the family. And I can remember the only time I ever met him was once, as his star began to descend,
mm-hmm.
there was a concert at DIA. Mrs. Wetzel took me backstage to meet him, but I always admired him because of his many talents. And actually, as a young man, my only black heroes were Joe Louis and Paul Robeson. The thing I remember about Detroit at that time, in the 40s, I remember taking the Woodward streetcar. It was a big deal to go downtown to the Fox, the Michigan, mm-hmm. the United Artists, and all the shows. And basically, I'm a loner. I have a lot of friends, and a lot of people care about me, and I care about them, but I tend to be reclusive at a certain time. And I can remember going down, especially after I got out of the service, we had the 3-6s, Sport Trees, the Larks, 606. And that was the action. Then the action moved down north on John R. And when I was in college, I'm a member of Alpha Phi Alpha. We used to, that was a, you know, the number one social things for black kids. We used to have our big dances at the Labor Temple. The Labor Temple was on the corner of Elizabeth and whatever that street is next to Woodward, going towards downtown. Like if you're going down, I don't think it was, it may have been Cass, I don't know, but I think it's Park.
Park.
And it was a very nice, it was the nicest place for blacks to have dances. You couldn't, well, the Greystones could have. And one of the funniest things growing up in Saginaw that I always remember, they used to have these, Duke Ellington would come to town, Count Basie, Lionel Hampton was a favorite too, and all these big bands at the Flint IMA Auditorium. Mm-hmm. They would have the white people would dance from 8 to midnight. Mm-hmm. Then they would have an intermission, and the blacks would dance from 1 to 5 or something like that. And that was a hell of a magnet because blacks from Saginaw, Bay City, a few blacks in Bay City, some from Detroit, Pontiac, they would all come to these dances. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, there would be breakfast. They would have breakfast and so on.
That's the way the Greystone was.
Yeah, Greystone was that way too. But I never went to the Greystone. The only time I went to Greystone was one night I took Jerry to, she didn't have a date, I took her to some convention down at the Greystone in the 50s, something like that. Had to be 49, I guess. So. But anyway, those were, and not to mention, I shouldn't forget the Paradise. Mm-hmm. The Paradise, even in high school, I used to come down and go to the Paradise.
Really?
Yeah.
Who do you remember seeing there?
I remember seeing Duke Ellington. And then Bowser, I can't remember, they used to call them, these guys, for lack of a better term, we call them a couple of female comedians, although they didn't. They were in slapstick. Mm-hmm. And I remember they would come out and they would do a, one guy was a straight man, the other guy was in whatever you call him. And he had a saying, what nature has forgotten, we fix with cotton, you know. And then one of my favorite memories is, it was very slapstick, and I'm surprised I can remember. I was telling my secretaries about that one day. There was a scene where this guy with black face and his very light-skinned wife, and only props on the stage was a bed and a table and a couple of chairs. And he said to his wife, "Now look, I'm going to work today. But don't you be holding that little baby boy because he knows what it's all about. Getting too, you know, he's getting worn up, and he might get too mannish and blah, 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 showing his insecurity." So he goes out the door, and she said, "Hot dog, I'm glad he's gone now again. Let me open the door and let my back door man, Sweet Papa Kim, come in." So Sweet Papa Kim comes in, and he says, they hug and kiss and talk. He said, "You know, baby, me and a couple hundred Jew boys were on the train going to Pontiac the other day, and I didn't know that there were two kinds of chicken, two parts of chicken." She said, "Oh, yeah, baby, there's the dark meat for the thighs and the white meat for the breast." He said, "Well, baby, you come on and sit down on my dark meat and put your head up on my white meat." You know, all right, so it goes on like this. Well, then the husband slips back in. Mm-hmm. "I caught you. I caught you." And then the guy gets down on his knees. He said, please don't shoot me because I come from Pontiac. And then he lets him go, and then she starts running around the bed. Mm-hmm. And he's chasing with the gun, and she faints on the bed, and her dress comes up to here. And then he walks in it. He puts his gun down. He starts taking off his coat and his shirt. He said, you know, baby, one of these days I'm going to hurt you. Now, actually, that sticks in my mind. There's a lot of things I saw down there. Billy Eckstein was another favorite, you know, especially black women. They liked him because he was a handsome man. Mm-hmm. And he was, to them, he was Frank Sinatra, you know. Mm-hmm. And then Lionel Hampton, he was famous. Mm-hmm. And then they always had, at the Paradise, they always had a black movie, black film, one of the black films. I can't give you any names, but Ralph Cooper or somebody like that. So that was the Paradise. And it was, you know, and then I can remember in college taking a girl to see Carousel at the Fisher. Afterwards, well, four of us, I didn't have the car, Buddy had the car. Afterwards, we went down to Sport Trees in Erskine Hawkins. It was Thanksgiving night. Well, that was a great night. And, you know, I had a ball that night. And on Monday nights, now this wasn't down in Paradise Valley because things were decentralized. Mm-hmm. There was a Bluebird on the west side. Mm-hmm. I used to go, when I first got out of the Navy, before I went to college, I used to go to a place on Euclid and Russell. That's a pretty rough neighborhood, but nobody would bother you if you kept your place. But some people, I used to go there and watch, listen to a guy called King Porter. And King Porter, I remember he used to do this King Porter Stomp. It was a working class bar. It was a nice place to go. Mm-hmm. Then, also on Mondays, we used to go to a place called Lee Sensation. That was on the north end.
And
they used to have, no, it was off of Oakland. But yeah.
His granddaughter is trying to write a story about his place, and she contacted me.
Well, I can remember going there, and one of the ones that I remember the most, now I like the blues, was Alberta Adams. I don't know if she's still singing or not, but Alberta Adams used to sing the song, and she had quite a derriere on her too, as I remember. And she'd sing the song, and I remember the punchline that one of them used to crank everybody up was, what makes my grandma love my grandpa so, and she would go several times. Mm-hmm. And the punchline would be, he got the same old stroke he had 50 years ago. And, in those days it was innuendo. Now they come out and say it, you know.
Yeah.
You know. So.
That one's pretty, that was pretty explicit.
Oh, that was explicit, yeah. That was very explicit. Slide them back a little more.
Okay.
And let's see.
Yeah, the blues really seem to be a little risque.
Oh, raunchy.
Yeah,
raunchy.
Very raunchy.
Very raunchy. But to me, it's a very, I mean, the ribaldry of that era was less offensive, you know. And you could laugh at it. And there was someone, sometimes you had to think, you know, it wasn't blatant. But there were some great times, and especially on Monday night, Blue Monday party, because you could get beer at half price, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And those were some great times. And there was another place I remember. It was down in Paradise Valley.
Alcino?
Elsino. I think it was the Elsino where Illinois Jacquet used to play. And Shirley, I mean, we used to be in the 6-on-6. She could sneak in there, and she, when we started dating, she was 18. She could have been really good by Elsino and drink beer. And we never had a problem. But in the night I graduated from Wayne in 1950, I borrowed a friend's ID so she could go, we could go to the Flame Show by and bar and party.
Yeah, I'm going to stop you because my little light is going out. I'm going to change the battery. Get a bright light. The bright light's back on. Okay. So we're in good shape.
About the LC door?
Yeah, what I'd like to know is, like, when you went in, what did it look like? What did it feel like? You know, what was the entertainment like? What were the drinks? You know, just...
Okay, well, one of the things you got to remember is that in those days, you had blacks were heavily into the clubs on Friday, Saturday, and maybe Sunday.
Okay.
But during the middle of the week, you had a lot of whites who came down.
Oh, okay.
That was, I remember being there in the middle of the week, and then Bobby Lane was the star quarterback for the Detroit Lions. You spent many evening in the Flame Chill Bar. I guess it was because they thought blacks were exotic, you know, it was different, and there was usually a format in some of these places. There was a guy who served, who was an MC, doubled as a comedian. Then you had, always had a shake dancer. And then there was a main star, like some cases, T-Bone Walker or somebody else. I remember T-Bone Walker used to be at the Flame a lot.
Okay, now that was later in the 50s, or that was
in the 50s.
Okay.
There was Flame didn't get formed until the 50s.
Yeah.
And then another thing that shows the segregation of the time, when we were in college after dances, if you didn't go to somebody's house as a formal party, we used to go to the China Casino, right across the street from the Frolic.
The China Casino?
Yeah. Right across the street on John Art.
Oh, okay.
And right next to where Randolph Wallace's bar in the Waha Room were, was a China Casino.
Okay.
And that was one of the few places you could eat Chinese food. Let's see. The Frolic, I remember going to the Frolics. I remember that's where I first saw Ziggy Johnson. Sometimes, like it, in the 50s, early 50s, maybe late 49, 50, 51. It was 49. Buddy and I used to go out every Tuesday night bar hopping. And I can remember going to Sport Trees to see the female impersonators.
Oh.
They had those at various times.
Okay.
And,
now, entertainers were always black in
those places. I don't know if anybody, you'd have to check newspapers to see who the headliners were at the Paradise. But most of the entertainers were black.
became a Paradise Theater.
Well, yeah, I didn't know it before.
Yeah, and it was Orchestra Hall.
Yeah, the Paradise Theater, then back to Orchestra Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And some, like, Stan Kent, I remember he used to go to concerts at the Masonic mm-hmm. Temple. Stan Kent, Duke Ellington,
mm-hmm.
Jazz at the Philharmonic.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bluebird was more of a jazz club. Then later on, Klein's.
Where was the Bluebird?
On the west side, it's still there. It's on Tireland.
It's not, still doesn't have music, does it?
I don't think it has music, but it's music. It's still there.
Mm-hmm.
No one forgot an important aspect. It was a gothic hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few hotels up on Adams there. Gotham was the best hotel for blacks in the city of Detroit. And you had, that's where Duke came, and, you know. I think one time somebody, Robeson came to town in the 40s before it became persona non grata to the establishment, and he stayed at the hotel. I remember the first time blacks went to the Oak Cadillac as a guest, sort of my fraternity had a national convention there in 1953.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 53 at the Oak Cadillac was a big deal. Usually there was a long bar. Places were mostly rather rectangular.
Okay.
Long bar,
mm-hmm.
and then at the Frolic, if I'm not mistaken, the stage was in back of the bar,
mm-hmm.
and the tables were over here,
mm-hmm.
and so the long bar people sat at tables over here, and everybody had a bouncer,
mm-hmm.
or a couple of bouncers.
Mm-hmm.
We had cigarette girls, and we had people going mm-hmm. around taking photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Tell you one something that happened to me back in, surprising I can remember this, back in 1948 when I was went to El Cino. I walked in and a guy, the coast college boy, the guy came up to me and said, "So, could I get you some lots of this smoke?" I said, "Oh, man, I don't use this stuff." You know, so you always had those guys who were trying to make a buck, a dishonest buck, you know. And you had some working girls working on a place. Another place, too, you should think about that was important was, you're at Freddie Ginion's in Dallas?
You know, I just heard about his. I've interviewed Freddie Ginyard, but I just heard the other day about his after-hours place. I have to, when I go back to see him.
Well, there's a place, I went to one after-hours place down there, because I had a cousin who was wasn't really my cousin, but he had no relatives, and I had to be a friend with him. And he stayed with her. And George, one night I saw him in El Cino, he had about $1,000 on him and about five women. And I wondered, what the hell is he doing with five women? But then afterwards we went to Chico's. I think it's Chico's. It was an after-hour place.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting, you know, very interesting. Because the bars closed at 12, people weren't ready to go home, and these places mm-hmm. took over.
And Paris closed at 12?
I mean, pardon me, 2.
2, yeah.
2. I remember they used to have a call. Last call for alcohol. So, that meant you had to, you know, buy and drink up and get out by 2:30, you know. And so then people knew they did these after-hour places they went to. And they, the reason they existed was because of the payoff, the policeman. Then you had the big shots, the guys with the money, the guys who were the numbers, you know. Numbers men were the big shots. Now, I don't remember. Well, some doctors and lawyers would go to places like the Fine, etc. Actually, when you stop to think of it, blacks were ghettoized in their entertainment possibilities. Now, there weren't that many restaurants you could go to. Like now, you know, go to Junior's or to the Opus One. And, you know, you forget that. So, eating out would entail going to meetings, going to one of the bank clubs. And to do something, if you were entertaining somebody, you want to do something, go to one of the clubs. And then afterwards, you get some barbecue. Sherry's Aunt was in the barbecue business. And I remember I used to work there and many nights, you know, when I was a manager, but I would help the help deliver because people were out partying. Somebody would order 10 barbecues, you know, right over, you know, that kind of stuff. Shrimp, fried chicken. So those were, and they were safe days, really. Because when I was working with her aunt in the 50s, nobody was ever robbed. It was not until 1965 or 4 or 5 when one of the drivers was robbed, and so she stopped delivering at that time. But you know, people did get robbed, but women were safer, men were safer. I reject the idea that things were always better in the past, but in this particular instance, it was. You know, and there was more of a feeling of community, and not as much robbery. Probably the worst thing that ever happened was the movement of plants and the availability of dope and narcotics or whatever. So, because people were smoking, you know, a few people were smoking and using heroin, but it wasn't until the degree that they got to be. That's when things changed. Because a guy can, one of the nice things about Detroit was a man with no skills, a strong back, could come here and work, and eventually after he got seniority could count on a pretty decent income, and if he didn't blow his money, he could have a home, and his kids could go to Wayne State University and get an education. But many a guy my age either worked his way through college by working at Ford or other plants in the summer, or some guys, older guys, used to work on the boats every summer. Met a lot of your doctors in Detroit, some of them are no longer with us. That's how they worked their way through college.
Oh, wow. But
I hadn't heard. I'd meet with you.
Well, that's, you know, you put I enjoyed you telling me about Paradise Theater very much. That was really great.
Yeah, it's a lot of, to me, it was exciting to, the lights would go down low and the announcers, and now we bring to you, direct from the Apollo in New York, Duke Ellington and his orchestra, you know, big, you know, and they, you know, I really love that music. It was an interesting time.
Now, let's go back to El Cino and the places in the Paradise Valley area. What, like, if you walked in, and you tell me what it looked like, physically, what would...
In the three sixes.
Mm-hmm. What was it, I mean, did they serve food?
I don't remember, because the Lark's was more of a bar, Lark's Grill, bar and grill.
Okay.
Some of them served food. I didn't get any food. The times I went to Chelsea was strictly a drink.
And what was it like? Did people all talk to each other and so on? Did people dress up?
Depends upon... Oh, yeah. There was not a very... People, you know, were sharp. You had to be sharp, you know? And the ladies were good. As a rule, they dressed well, you know. They weren't too casual.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nobody came in jeans, you know. Usually a suit or a sport coat.
Mm-hmm.
In the summer you had an open shirt, you know. Maybe some people didn't have on coats, but everybody looked good.
Now, on the days that you said that blacks and whites sort of alternated, but if they were there together, was there
any problem? No problem. I mean, there was, actually, I can remember, this is an updating the story. I can remember after we moved to Northwest Detroit in 63, about a year before the riot, a friend took us, that's about 65, took us downtown. We went downtown to the Adams and we saw a picture. The picture was out of harm's way. It was John Wayne. It was about the Navy during World War II. We ate at Victor Lim's, and then we ate first and we were free. We, going home, this guy had was going to use his credit card. I knew where there was a Amoco, whatever it was called. No, it was Amoco Station. Just before you got to the freeway, the Ford Freeway on Rush, I can remember going up in the station and seeing all the fine guys down there buying flesh, you know? And this is true on Mack Avenue as well as, you know, this is what they did.
In the gas station?
No, I mean, you could see them on the street.
Oh, I see.
There was an apartment
when you stopped there. Okay.
They were stopped there. And I'd forgotten, because by that time, you know, with four kids and and working, I didn't have much time to go around and see and do things, you know. And that was the time, I think, after, in the 60s, I don't think we went to any nightclubs or stuff, mostly parties, house parties, or something, 50s and 60s. So we didn't go to places because we didn't have the money. And I still remember, I'd say, Dad, look at these guys down there, you know. I was just surprised, but that was their game. But then after the riot and the resurgence of nationalism, a guy might get hurt, a white guy who came down to purchase the favors of a prostitute. Oh, yeah.
Well, did I ask you everything?
You never do, but having done this myself, but I'll be happy to talk to you anytime, you know.
Okay.
About,
Okay, well, you've filled in a good gap. Okay.
And I worked there for a year. Afternoons, so I could, well, 3 o'clock, and so I could do my student teaching and all that stuff. And that was a fascinating experience because it taught me a lot to have compassion for people, because there were no drugs in those days, no tranquilizers. And I can remember having to wrestle patients in the ground, put them in human restraints so the nurse could sedate them. And then we were on 3-1, 3-2, 2-1, and 2-2 were the women's sports.
Mm-hmm.
And this was at the time when they had a horrible census of mental patients.
Mm-hmm.
And only the senile, older senile, only older senile psychotics had the beds.
Mm-hmm.
In the wards, and so we used to put down the cots on both sides of the hall.
Mm.
And in the room where they ate their meals, and so we'd have to go down in the women's ward and do the same thing. And I did an informal survey, and most of the guys in my ward, who the whites were usually Polish or Appalachian whites,
mm-hmm.
and you had a number of blacks. I mean, blacks and yellows vary, but those seem to be the three types.
Mm.
And I remember asking the psychiatrist one day, what was the number one cause, for mental problems? He said, unpleasant childhood experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some of it's genetic, but it's a very small percentage. But it was fascinating
mm-hmm.
working down there. And sometimes I think the mental patients were ahead of us in terms of adjusting, because they could get over differences in race much easier than we could in 1952.
Well, one area that I know is, that I've always noticed, and being in kind of a creative area, is that creative people are very rarely hung up on race. People who are artists, mm-hmm. entertainers, and so on. Because the first thing that's important to them is the creativity.
And the talent.
Is the talent. So when an artist looks at another individual, they're drawn to someone who has talent and who is another artist, and that comes first before any other consideration.
Yeah.
And so maybe people who have mental problems are
creative.
Maybe they're creative.
Some of them are.
Well, sometimes there are people who really have a more acute sense of what's going on, so they know to be afraid. And I think artists are that way too. You know, creative people are that way too. They know what's going on before other people know what's going on. So. Well, thank you very much.
You are